nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So I guess the last few lectures have been trying to describe to you this ballistic transport, the idea of ballistic transport, which is somewhat different from what we had discussed earlier back in September, where we said, okay, we have some density of states, and electrons can come in at a rate gamma 1, can go out at a rate gamma 2. And if we put those things equal, gamma 1 equals to gamma 2, equal to gamma, then you'd have an equation that would look something like this. This is like what we had back in September. And now what we are talking about is a channel that's fairly long, so that the rate at which electrons can get out into the contact is really depends on the length of the channel. In the sense, the rate determining time is how long it takes for electrons to get through this thing. And in that case, you could use kind of the same formula, but instead of gamma being just something that depends on how good your contact is, it's really more related to how fast an electron gets through your channel. And so you can put this h bar vx over l. And then the quantity you have here, that's what we call this number of modes, the density of modes. Right? And the thing that we have gone through in all of October is how you start from atomistic theory and get a EK relationship, something like this. And when you have a wire that carries current in one direction, you can draw E versus K, K in that particular direction, which I could call X. And you have various subbands like this. Okay? And you can group the states into two categories, one that carries current in plus X, another that carries current in minus X. One that has a positive group velocity, other that has a negative group velocity. So previously it was like all we had was a density of states. Now we have a way of classifying them, two groups of things. And the occupation of these states for ballistic transport, the interesting thing is that if you have good contacts and you have this ballistic channel, then the plus K states are occupied according to the chemical potential in contact one, because all the electrons going in this direction, they all came from here. Whereas all the electrons going in the opposite direction, they all came from there. So, you know, for this discussion, let's think we are at low temperatures. So everything up to mu 1 is filled, everything up to mu 2 is filled. So the thing is, if I look in this energy range, there's nothing coming from the right. And what that means is in this energy range, these negative K states would just be completely empty. Why? Because the only way you could have an electron here going this way, going to the left, is if it came from the right contact. Because anything that comes from the left contact, you know, just comes in and goes out. That's it. So the only way you could be going the other way is if you came from the right contact. And what that means is that if we're at low temperatures and let's say this chemical potential is here, then in this energy range, there's nothing coming from the right contact. The Fermi function is zero. And hence, these states are all completely empty, whereas these states are all completely full. And this is a very nice clean situation that you have in ballistic conductors, that you have two groups of states, one group that's filled according to left, one group that's filled according to right. And so, when you want to calculate electron density inside, you could say I'll take half my density of states, fill it up according to the left Fermi function, take the other half, fill it up according to the right Fermi function. Say it that way. Or actually what we had in September, if you put gamma 1 equals gamma 2, you get this anyway. Actually, it's just that now you have this clean division, whereas in September it was more like, okay, you got 100 states and they're all about half full. Because one contact fills it up, one contact empties it. And so if gamma 1 is equal to gamma 2, then all these states around here are kind of half full. Whereas ballistic transport, what you're saying is, it's like not they're all half full. It's like half of them are completely full and half are completely empty. That's the thing. And there's a net current because these are the ones that carry current to the right. These are the current ones that carry current to the left. And these are not occupied. That's why you have a net current. Below this, around here, in this energy range, both groups are equally occupied. And so no current flows. Only currents right up there. Right? Now, what I got started discussing last day is that in this picture, how you think about diffusive transport. What I mean by that is when you have, say, lots of scatterers around here, which is typically what would happen when you have a big conductor. And what does a scatterer do? Well, it takes something going to the right and sends it backwards. So it turns this flow into backward flow. So what that means is you would expect that you don't have this clean division anymore. There will be electrons around here which are actually going the opposite way. Why? They didn't come from this contact. They started here, but then they got turned around, which is why they ended up in a minus K state. Right? So in a long diffusive conductor, lots of scattering, you would have a situation like this. And usually people think in terms of something they call a mean free path. That is, how far does an electron go before, on the average, before it gets turned around? And what we were discussing last day was that in that case, you could think of it sort of like this, that let's, you know, if all these were filled, then as you know, the current, I plus, that's the amount of current carried by these electrons. That would be basically Q over H times, as you know, this quantity we call the number of modes. And let's say in this energy range, we are just talking about this energy range, you know, where the Fermi function here is 1 and the Fermi function here is 0. These are all unoccupied, these are all occupied. And we're trying to figure out what current flows. And in this energy range, you'd say, okay, let's say we have a certain number of modes, a constant number. I won't worry about how it varies in this energy range, just some number. So it's Q over H times that number, and times whatever this energy range is. That's mu 1 minus mu 2, which is this applied voltage. And of course, if it was ballistic transport, that is the current. And in which case, you'd say that the conductance is I over V, and that's Q square over H times the number of modes. Should you have a 2 here? Now, that's a matter of bookkeeping where you want to put the 2. That is, whether you want to think of 2 as part of the number of modes, or if your modes doesn't include 2, then you should put a 2 there. Okay. Now, what causes some confusion sometimes is this, that when people talk about density of states, they usually include the spin in it. So it's like total density of states. Up spin half, ups down spin half, they give you the total. But when they talk about modes, they often tell you just per spin. And so you have all kinds of factors of 2 coming up here and there. Because when they're writing D, they're including the spin. When they're doing M, they're not including the spin. Okay? But so that's the thing that you have to be careful about in terms of how you do the bookkeeping on that 2. Okay. But this is the current that you'd have then if it was ballistic. On the other hand, if you have diffusive transport, then that number simply tells you what's coming in from this contact. This is I plus. And of course, as it goes down this channel, along this entire channel, it gradually gets lower and lower to some value. Why is that? Because all this stuff going to the right is continually getting turned back, getting turned into the backflow, I minus. On the other hand, if you look at the current going backwards, you could say, well, on this side it's 0. Here I minus is 0. Here. But then, as you go through the channel, you'll find it goes up.
like this.
And the net current is always the difference between the two. And that, you can expect, should be the same no matter where I look. Because if I stand anywhere here and I find that there's more net current on one side than the other, then you can't have steady state. Because then the number of electrons inside will keep changing with time. You know, because you got 100 coming in and 90 leaving, then of course there will be a constant changing of the electron density. So steady state in 1D, current has to be the same everywhere. And current is the difference between the two. So what I tried to do last day at the end of the class, towards the end, we were kind of rushed, so I'm kind of going over that part, is trying to show you how you would get this behavior from a simple different, by writing a simple differential equation for this. Okay? And the way it would work is something like this. That you ask the question, what is the change in the, if I go across a region of length dx, then how much does the I plus change going from left to right of that region? So what is the dI plus? And the idea is that, I guess I should, you know, I plus is something that is changing across the whole thing, whereas what I've written here, by the way, is the value it takes on at the left end. So I'll call this I1. So that's like the value right here, whatever it is. Whereas this one is zero at this end. But then, of course, it changes across the thing. But those are like the boundary values of this thing. Okay. Now, how much does I plus change going across a region of dx? Well, the thing is that a fraction of the electrons gets turned back when you do this. What fraction is it? Well, the thing is that the way you define mean free path is that if you go a certain distance dx, then the fraction that gets turned back is like dx over mean free path. That's almost like the definition of mean free path. So you could say di plus is minus I plus, and then dx divided by mean free path. Now, if this was it, so I could take the dx from here and put it here, then you see I plus would have kind of gone down exponentially. But this is not quite it, because what we are saying here is that whatever comes in from here, it gets turned around, some of it, and the rest of it goes through. And so it decreases by that much. But then there's also electrons coming from here, and some of it gets reflected, and that actually adds to what was going in that direction. And so there's this minus I plus, but then there is an equivalent term that comes from the negative flow. And this one is plus, because it kind of adds to that flow. And I plus minus I minus, that's of course the net current, which is a constant everywhere. And so you could write this as di plus dx is equal to minus I over lambda, where I is the net current, which is a constant. So now you can see that when I look at this I plus, it will not go down exponentially or anything else. It will just go down linearly. Linearly why? Well, di dx is a constant. So anything, any curve whose, you know, derivative is a constant is a straight line. That's it. So what you now know is, what this tells you right away is that this will go down linearly like so. And, of course, let me write that here. And what I claim is that if I looked at the backflow, that's this one, that should also have exactly the same slope. Those two things have to be parallel. And that you can kind of see physically, that that's because the difference between the two, which is this much, or this much, or this much, or this much, that has to be the same no matter where you go. Why? Because the difference is the net current. And that is the same no matter whether you're at this end or that end. You see? So what that means is the dI plus dx must also be equal to dI minus dx. Because those two slopes, if they were not equal, then what would have happened is, you know, this curve might have looked like that. In that case, the current here would be different from the current there. Now, what we'd like to do then is, right, kind of figure out what these things are at various points, whatever it is. Now, one thing we can do is, let's say the current is I, you know, and that's a constant everywhere. Now, what that tells me is, how much is I, guess I'm writing I2 plus, can you help me? You see, I know the slope of this. And if I know it at one side, I could write what it is on the other side. That's easy enough. And this length, of course, is L. This is L. That's the length of your channel. So my point is, yeah. So can you, I know that I2 minus is 0. So actually, why don't I write I2 quickly then? So since I know it's 0 here, can you help me write what it is here? Right. So, yeah, I guess if this is 0, this should be positive. Right? Should be positive, right? Because it's going down. That's why the slope is negative. I L by lambda, right. So this will be I L over lambda. That's easy enough. Now the thing is, in order to calculate the current, I need to know, or rather what I want to complete is I want to know this and this also. So can you help me with how much this is, I2 plus? Yeah, the thing is, you see, the current is I. Now, anywhere I can't quite tell you because all it tells you is this. This much is I. So I don't know what this is and what this is. I mean, this could be one thing. I mean, just I know the difference is there. But here, the nice thing is I know one of them is zero. So this should be, you know, because this much is I. So it, this has to be I, right? It's because the other one is zero. Anywhere else I couldn't have guessed. Because I don't know this, I don't know this one, so I can't write that one. But here I can easily write it. So now can you tell me what this one is? Right. So this was IL over lambda, and now it will be I plus that. That's what it will be. So what comes in from here is actually a lot bigger than the net current that actually flows. The net current is this I. So for example, if this thing were, say, 10 mean free paths long, then you see what comes in from here is like 11 times the actual current that came in from here. Because in a way, what's happening is a lot of current comes in here, but only 1/11th of it actually gets through this whole thing. And that's what you finally get, you see. If it was 10 mean free paths long. Okay. So what you could do, now after this, of course, if you wanted to find what is I, then the way I could do it is, I could say that I know that at this end, I1 plus must be equal to this. And that's equal to I times 1 plus L over lambda. So I can figure out what I is. So I could do that. For example, let me take this off of here. So I could say, okay, that is equal to Hence, I over V is equal to Q squared over H times M times lambda over L plus lambda. That would be one way to do it. And now what you're saying is then that the conductance is your ballistic conductance, but then reduced by this factor. And of course, if your channel is much shorter than a mean free path, I can drop it. That factor is just one. If this happens to be, say, 10 mean free paths long, then this factor is like 1 over 11. So the conductance would be 1/11th of the ballistic conductance. That's basically it. So you take the ballistic conductance, look at what you're getting experimentally, look at what you're actually measuring, and the ratio is sort of tells you then how many mean free paths long it is. That's about it. And so what I had said last day was that, you know, when you try to calculate the current, it's like we have the same thing here still, but then you have to add this extra factor of lambda over L plus lambda. Okay, so I'll just put that in here. And in a way, you could say that as if the gamma, you see, the way we had defined gamma was how easily the thing can escape from the channel. And now you see, because of all this scattering, it's much hard, takes an electron much longer to get out of the channel. So one way to think of this would be, well, it's just that the time to get out became a whole lot longer, and so the gamma became a whole lot smaller. That's one way to think. So it's still pi d gamma, just that the gamma got smaller. That's one way to think. Another way to think is, well, you know, you had, this was the ballistic case, and this just tells you what fraction gets through of all that, etc. However you like it, but the point is, this is the equation that more or less does it. This one, of course, needs more discussion, because previously it was like we had one uniform channel and you talked about the total electron density. Now you can see the electron density is actually kind of changing from one end to the other. Because if you think about it, on this side, you know, we are talking of electrons in this energy range. On this side, you have no electrons going backwards, and say 20 electrons going forwards. So you have some electron density associated with that. When you come here, it's like you got 100 going backwards and 120 going forwards. So a whole lot more electrons on this side. So if you want to calculate the electron density, it's changing from left to right, of course. You got lots of them here, very few here, and it's proportional to this I1 plus I2. You know, current is the difference between those two, but electron density is like proportional to the sum of the two. So, yeah, I guess I could take this off probably, because the final result of all this was this. And this, as I said, is needs more discussion, because this is like the total electron density. If you're interested in talking about how it varies, you need not a number n, but you need something like n of x. Now, one thing that you could do, and let me write that equation I had before up here. Now, I had this equation, d I1 plus dx is equal to, I'm sorry, di plus dx is equal to di minus dx is equal to minus I over lambda. That was the equation we had before. Now, if you want to write an equation in terms of electron density, because one of the things, those of you who have taken 305 or have talked about, you know, seen how people think about current flow in diffusive conductors, you've probably seen a diffusion equation that sometimes people write. So the diffusion equation would have looked something like, you know, I equals minus Q, the diffusion coefficient. They usually write it as D, except that I've used D for density of states. Let's I'll write a kind of funny looking D, so you know it's a different thing we're talking about. And then dN dx. Right? That's the kind of equation you'd have seen diffusion equation. What's the current? Well, it's proportional to the gradient in the electron density. And the question is, could you have written something like that here? Well, it could do something like this. See, I plus is equal to, as you know, in general, current is QNV. So you could say this is Q times N plus. That means how many electrons are going forwards times the V. And I minus is how many electrons are going backwards times V. So you could say that if I want something like dN dx, what I should be looking at is the sum of these two. Well, I got this one and this one. So if I just add those up, what I should get is d dx of I plus I minus is equal to minus 2i over lambda. You could do that. And then you could say I plus I minus is like the total electron density times QV. So I could put a QV here and then turn this into N. So QV dN dx is this. So if I turn that around, I could write I is equal to minus QV lambda over 2 dN dx. Could have taken that same equation, turned it around, and written it that way. And now if you compare it with the standard diffusion equation, you can see that this is the quantity that's kind of like the diffusion coefficient. The velocity of these electrons times the mean free path. You know, that has the dimensions of like meters per second and meters, or centimeters per second, centimeter. That's like centimeter square per second. That's what diffusion coefficient, those are the dimensions of diffusion coefficient. Now, only thing is that usually the way mean free path is defined, diffusion coefficient is usually V lambda without the 2. And the reason we have this 2, I believe, is the following. That the way people normally think of mean free path is that, you see, I have an electron coming this way, and it gets scattered. And usually in this discussion, we are assuming this scattering is isotropic. So an electron's coming this way, and it gets scattered. It can be scattered by any angle. You know, could be completely turned around, could be just 10 degrees, whatever it is. It's all uniform. Now, usually the way you think of mean free path is that, how far does the electron go before it just gets scattered? Question is, you don't ask the question whether it's 5 degrees, 10 degrees, whatever. It's whatever it takes, whatever scattering might be. On the other hand, if you see an electron turned by that much, it would still be carrying current in the forward direction. And so, in this discussion, what really matters is what you would call the mean free path for back scattering. That is, what is the, how far does an electron go before it is turned backwards? That's the thing. And if the entire scattering process is isotropic, then you could say roughly 50, you know, if you get scattered once every, let's say, 1 nanosecond, then the time it takes for you to get backscattered would be 2 nanoseconds. Why? Because half the time, of course, you wouldn't get backscattered. You're still kind of going forwards anyway. So that, I think, is why we have this extra factor of 2 in here. That's about it. That the, usually the way mean free path is defined is a little different from the way we defined it here. So this mean free path is like the mean free path for backscattering, which is a little longer than the usual mean free path. That's about it. Little longer meaning a factor of 2 between them. That's just a matter of definition. I could have, instead of lambda, just written lambda over 2. You see, call that lambda over 2, and then it would have been the same. Okay. Actually, the next homework, which will be due next week on Friday, and we'll be posting it today, what I ask you to do there is, in the first problem, show you some recent experimental data from graphene, actually. See, where what people measure is how the conductance changes when they change this gate voltage. So they have a gate on top with which they can change the, essentially move this density of states up and down. Or you could say density of states is fixed, you just move the chemical potential up and down, however. And the plot, what conductance you get against what is the electron density. See, and as you know, in graphene, the density of states looks something like this. There is a point where the density of states goes to zero, and then it increases linearly upwards and it increases linearly downwards. And so when people plot this conductance as a function of electron density, so zero is when the chemical potential is here. I mean, that's like a reference. So if you move it down, you call it negative. Move it up, you call it positive. And the conductance, though, increases in both directions, and you see something like this. That's what's measured experimentally. And based on what we have discussed, and I think we had, did some of this back in homework 3 also, we look at that, we could actually see if we can understand the experimental data, roughly, what is happening. And you can see that, of course, the experiments are not for ballistic transport. It's like there is a mean free path. And they have 2 sets of data. One is for the sample before annealing, and the other is after annealing. And what annealing does to a sample is it kind of moves scatterers around a little bit and increases the mean free path. That is, when you first grow this sample, it tends to be relatively disordered. And so there's a lot of scattering. So lambda is short. You can only go a short distance before you get turned wrong. Lambda meaning the mean free path. And so they have these 2 sets of data, sort of. You know, one set before annealing, when the conductance is low, and then when you anneal it, the mean free path changes and you have something else. So that's like in your this homework. And one of the things I think we are getting was that the mean free path, you'll see, that we need to fit it, is kind of half of what is quoted there. And the explanation, I believe, is what I just told you. Rather, the mean free path you need is double of what is quoted there. Right.
In the diffusive theories treatment, I think people usually use an expression called the Einstein relation, bringing together the diffusion coefficient and the mobility. So, how can we get the mobility from this model?
Yeah, what happens is, there are 2 limits in which the expressions usually get simple. One of them is the limit that we are just discussing now, which is where we say that the temperature is very low. And so we have a range of energies where current flow takes place, and the rest you don't worry about. That's it. And in that case, the standard equation looks like this, and there's an expression for D, density of states, which would be just like, not density of states, the diffusion coefficient, and which is just what we said, V lambda. Okay. Now, the other limit that people often talk about in semiconductors is what's called the non-degenerate limit. So non-degenerate means actually these mu's are somewhere down here. And conduction takes place over this entire energy range, actually. The whole region out here. And the result is that when you, because the conduction takes place over this entire range, over a range of kT or so, usually people write an expression often that looks like I equals this Q N mu U type of, right? That's the one you're talking about, the mobility, and then there's this Einstein relation between them. But this one suggests that current is proportional to electron density, and that is not quite right, because you can see right here, for example, that in graphene, if you go into this part, then electron density is actually going down if you look at total electrons. And yet, conductance is going up. No way, right? And I guess one way you could patch it up is by saying, well, once you're down here, you have to think of holes and all that. And here you can see if the temperature is high, conduction could be taking place, partly electrons, partly holes. And then it's not so easy to see how to use an expression like this.
In this case, I think we considered that the temperature was low, since we said that we have this window, which is well defined.
Right, right. So I worked with that one. Now, often what...
In this case, it's not easy to have a smooth transition to get this parameter for mobility.
Right, so that data I use in this homework problem, you know, which we'll post it today, that's a relatively low temperature data. Relatively meaning not room temperature, it's more like, say, 40 Kelvin or so. And so on this scale of things, usually the temperature is like maybe about that much on this scale of things, right? And as you're moving it around. So the part where you worry is when you're actually going through this minimum. And actually, there's a lot of debate now exactly what this minimum conductivity should be. Because theoretically, it goes to zero. But actually, what people measure is, it doesn't quite go to zero. And there's a lot of debate on exactly what that number is. That's separate. But the point I'm trying to make is that if you use an expression like this, then I think it holds no matter what. Whether you have non-degenerate conductors, degenerate conductors, you use the appropriate Fermi functions, everything, that should work out. Whereas lots of things like this are kind of special things that only work under certain conditions, not always. Okay. Now, so the point here then is that you could use a diffusion equation, but the thing is that when you solve a diffusion equation, if I were doing this, your tendency would be to say the electron density is something here and it is zero at this end. Because you'd say, well, you know, we are talking about this energy range and here there are no electrons, so it's zero here and it's got some value there. And you're talking of electrons in this energy range. And you see, that wouldn't be quite right. Because here, there is nothing coming back, but there is something going forwards. And so N is really not zero. And of course, the closer you are to ballistic transport, the more important that becomes, that part. So if you are solving this equation and just putting N equal to zero here, you're really not getting it right, and it wouldn't work in the ballistic limit of things. Because as you know, in the as you get closer to the ballistic limit, this picture would end up looking more like this. More and more like that. You see, because, you see, close to the ballistic limit, it's like this is getting smaller, and the value I had here was I1, this is I2 plus, equals I. And these two are now almost equal, because if L is very small compared to a mean free path, let's say, then that's really equal to that, et cetera. And so a very important part of this whole story then is this extra thing here, and it's not really zero, et cetera. So this is the thing that when you're using diffusion equation, and as I said, back in the 80s, that more or less covered everything, and that's what people talked about. And it's only in the late 80s and early 90s that it became clear that to understand ballistic transport, you really needed to revise the way you think about all this. Okay? And so if you looked at the overall conductance, point I had made was, if you looked at the overall conductance, it looks like Q square over H times M times lambda over L plus lambda. That's the conductance. And if you turn that around, you could write the resistance. So the resistance would be H over Q square, 1 over M. You know, this is 25.9 kilo ohms, number of modes. And then you can write it as 1 plus L over lambda. Turn this around this way. Now, the thing is that this resistance, that first term, that is what corresponds to a ballistic resistor. Because if L were zero, if L was very short compared to a mean free path, that's the resistance you'd have got. That's this quantum of conductance divided by the number of modes. But as you introduce more and more scattering inside the channel, the resistance gets bigger. And this is the extra part that kind of follows Ohm's law and grows with length. But there is a constant here, you see? And if you take current times resistance, that's like the voltage overall. So it's sort of like you can see that if you looked at how this thing is changing, this is like how the occupation of levels is changing. So you could kind of think of this as the quasi-Fermi level that is changing gradually across the channel. And you can see that the voltage, there is a big drop right here. Right here because, if I were to look at, say, the average occupation, because, you know, the electron density depends on the average of the sum of the two. So if I were to draw an average here, it would be something like this. Of course, once I get inside the contact, then I know those two have to match. Those two will have to connect up. Because inside the contact, they all have the same chemical potential. Inside the contact, I1 plus is almost equal to I1 minus. So you can see, so the way you think about it is like as if the total voltage that you applied kind of drops a little bit here, drops a little bit here, and a little bit across your actual channel. And this part of it, you think of it as if it's this interface resistance. That's this term. And the middle part, that's this one. That's the part that grows. Right? Now, one question is, inside the contact, why would the two join up? And what does it take to make a good contact? Because this is, again, one of the issues that you come into whenever dealing with small devices, because so much depends on the contact. So what exactly does it mean to have a contact here? And the important point is this, that in a way, the real definition of a good contact is that it's got an extremely large number of modes. Because, you see, the current carried is proportional to the number of modes times this. For a given current, the difference between the two chemical potentials, I guess I had this here. So, you know, the current is carried because you have a difference in the chemical potential on this side and on this side. You have two different numbers. So these are occupied a little less than that one. Now, inside a contact, what happens is because you have a very large number of modes, you can still carry the current without having any significant difference between the two occupations, just because you've got thousands of modes. And so even if there is just a 1% difference between them, that's enough to carry a current. So that is why the I1 plus and I1 minus on this scale of things kind of gets almost the same inside a contact. The fractional occupation, at least, becomes the same inside. Actually, I1 plus wouldn't quite change. I'm kind of, because the current itself would remain the same. But if you look at the current per mode, that is what would become approximately almost the same inside. That difference would become almost insignificant. Okay. Anyway, so the important thing then is that it is this part that was always missed before. This is the part in that is very important in ballistic transport. And in real devices that have, let us say, two or three mean free paths long, you cannot quite ignore this. Whereas if this one is in hundreds of mean free paths, you can ignore it. Okay? Now, the other topic that I want to talk about the next couple of classes, and that's this thing about coherent transport. Now, what I mean by that is, I just wanted to explain this today, and we'll go on next day. Now, that has to do with, you see, what I said here is, when you have lots of scatterers inside, then the reason the resistance gets less, resistance gets bigger when you make it longer, is because there are more scatterers. So if you have 50 scatterers, you might turn back, say, 1/10 of the current. When you have 100 scatterers, you might just, you'll be turning back a lot more of it. Okay. Now, what isn't clear is the amount of electrons turned back, does it depend only on the number of scatterers, or does it depend on how they are positioned, how they, etc.? And the point here is that if you think of electrons as particles, then what you can show is that whatever I just discussed, that's enough. That describes it quite well. But because electrons are these waves, there is what you call interference. What you expect is interference effects. What that means is that if I have a channel with, say, one scatterer, and if I have a channel with, say, two scatterers, the implication was that if, let's say, we have 10 electrons coming in per second, then let's say one electron gets out here, and the other 9 go back. Now, with two scatterers and 10 coming in per second, question is, how many do you expect will get through? And the answer you'd think would be something less than 1. And the thing is, any description where you think of electrons as particles, any reasonable description, will always give you some number less than 1. No question. What that means is, okay, the resistance you have for one scatterer, with two scatterers, you should have a bigger resistance. That's pretty clear. Okay. But if you think of electrons as waves, then that's not necessarily true. Because what you could have is interference, namely, that the electron that the reflection you get from here and the reflection you get from here, if this happens to be like a half a wavelength, if this happens to be a quarter of a wavelength, then this reflection and that one can cancel. Okay? And so what could happen is that with one scatterer, 10 come in, only 1 gets through. But with two scatterers, 10 come in and all 10 get through. You could have something like this. You see? So this is what you call interference, and that, of course, would be a direct evidence of the wave nature of electrons. Now, normally, you never run into this. I mean, normally, when you put, as I said, when you put resistors in series, they act according to Ohm's law. Now, why is that? Well, there's a number of, I guess, two reasons. One of them has to do with the fact that usually you have many, many subbands involved, and each one has a different associated wavelength. Because wavelength, as you know, is related to this k. So this k sort of tells you that when an electron goes a certain distance, how much its phase changes. And of course, in order to have this very perfect cancellation, this has to be exactly a certain phase, you know, say pi over 2. And what will usually happen is that when you have 20 modes, some of them might cancel, but then some of them won't. And then when you average it all out, you won't notice. That's one thing. The other thing is that usually at room temperature especially, your solid is not completely static. The atoms are kind of jiggling around all the time. And so this region between the scatterers is kind of like a thing that's moving around. And so they might cancel out right now, but then 1 picosecond later, things have kind of changed and they don't cancel. And of course, anything we measure is averaged over time, and definitely over a nanosecond, possibly milliseconds. when you look in your oscilloscope. And so, again, you never see, quite see this. But what people did see, you see, back in the late 80s, was that when they took some of these small conductors down to low temperatures, they would see a conductance that didn't look like this, but there was an enormous amount of what looked like noise. You see? And now, first you thought this is just noise. But then the thing is, you go back the next day and it's exactly the same pattern. So it's not like uncontrolled noise. And what they think it is it's again interference. Interference meaning you have all these impurities, and depending on how they are arranged, you get a certain pattern. Because sometimes they interfere a little more constructively and sometimes a little more destructively. And what they found was that if they take this conductor, and this they're measuring at low temperatures, but they bring it up to room temperature, and then they cool it down again. And now they find they have a totally different pattern. You know, the peaks and troughs have all moved. And the explanation for that, what is believed, is that when you bring it up to room temperature, what happens is the impurities move around a little bit. And so when you cool it back again, it's kind of like a different sample. You know, same impurity, number of impurities, just that they have moved around, rearranged themselves somewhat, and so the whole interference pattern has changed. But then as long as you keep it cold, it stays that way, day after day. So this is what people refer to as conductance fluctuations. And actually, you'll see again this in this homework problem, I show give you a plot from one of the recent papers. And they say that we show you the data at 60 Kelvin so as to get rid of conductance fluctuations. Meaning that if they had showed you the data at 4 Kelvin, it would have looked kind of like this. By 60 Kelvin, it's clean. You know, it looks like this. And that you can understand without bringing in the wave nature of things at all. So this is then the direct evidence of this wave nature. And what I'll try to do in the next few lectures is to give you a feeling for how one thinks about these things, deals with these things, and why is it that normally you don't have to worry? And why? And I guess the basic answer is normally you don't have to worry because all these interference things get washed out, either because it's jiggling around or because it's averaged over lots of things. Okay? Well, let me stop here today. Thanks.